Just a friendly reminder to anyone or everybody to please put your cell phones on silence or vibrate. And as usual, try to take a break at the 90-minute mark or in between agenda items. Before we get into reports on recent activities or any suggested changes to the agenda, Paul Howard.
Mr. Chairman, tomorrow under Groundfish tab, let me see the agenda item, is at 1:30, Groundfish Committee Report Session, tab 3. There's two agenda items at 1:30 tomorrow. I suggest that we do the ACL AMs first. And the second agenda item would be looking at the Eliminator Trawl and the Norbait Cape Cod Hook research to look at whether or not we send those to service, asking them to approve those gears for U.S. Canada. But I think the ACL AM is the primary agenda, so I'd like to do that one first, if that's okay.
Any objection? Okay. We'll reverse the order of those tomorrow. Any other comments on the agenda? Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, under that same item, one, what would be now the second one on the U.S.-Canada discussion, we will probably bring up another item concerning the haddock fishery, essentially under the same thing for discussion.
Okay. Anything else? All right, then, seeing no more additions or comments on the agenda, I'll move right into reports. The Executive Committee met. It's in tab 1, behind tab 1, document number 2. We met on January 23rd. And I'll quickly run through the contents of that report. The SSC nominees have been appointed. 15 individuals. For a three-year term, John Anila, Steve Cadron, Victor Greco, John Gates, Dan Georgiana, John Honig, Les Kaufman, Jacob Kreitzer, J.J. McGuire, Robert O'Boyle, Rob Robertson, Andrew Rosenberg, and Alexei Sheroff, Mike Sissonwine, and Patrick Sullivan. The new SSC policies mailed along with the appointment letters, so they should have those letters by now. The Executive Committee went through the advisory panel nominees and selected the APs for a three-year term. I believe those letters have also made it through the Postal Service, and new members should have their letters in hand. There was a discussion on proposed changes to the sector policy. That's going to come up today at 1:45. There's two items that will be discussed at that point. The scallop survey advisory panel, we've put Dave Simpson and Jim Salisbury as council representatives, Bill DePaul, Glenn Nutting, Scott Gallagher as state academic members, plus Richard Taylor, Charlie Quinn, and Ron Smallowitz as industry members from New England. I believe also that the Mid-Atlantic Council is in the process or has identified council members and industry to be part of that as well. I don't have the names right now, but they're coming shortly. The 4 p.m. agenda item today is a discussion of the skate amendment development timelines. The executive committee was briefed on that issue, but again, we'll get into that today at 4 o'clock. The AP section and enforcement section of the operations handbook were discussed by the executive committee, and that's a 1:45 agenda item today. There's a document number 3, which talks about that. It looks like in April we'll have a look at a budget from Paul Howard. The EFP consultation process is the first agenda item tomorrow, Wednesday at 8:30. We'll have a general discussion let's see. We also got a brief on possible change in how we do business with respect to approval of amendments or frameworks. I think Paul Howard's going to lead a discussion on that item. But essentially, the council needs to, in its process of forwarding documents, needs to, or plan changes, needs to approve the regulations or draft of the regulations before it submits everything. So Paul's going to lead us through a discussion on that. We just talked about tomorrow the approval of additional gears in U.S. Canada. That's an agenda item for tomorrow. There was some confusion over whether or not the service had seats and voting rights on some of our committees. The executive committee has identified the groundfish, the scallop, and the habitat committees as places where the service will have a seat and a vote. We received a letter from an industry representative concerning the scheduling of committee meetings on Mondays and Fridays, and the concern that this is difficult, and the thought that we need to try not to schedule meetings on those days for obvious reasons, and we do try to, but ultimately we have meetings on days that the majority of the committee members can attend the meeting. And at this time of the year, things are so tight that we have had to have a few meetings on Monday and Friday. And then there was a discussion at the executive committee concerning the emergency action request for Area 1 SAP. Any questions? Okay. Paul Howard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things. The draft environmental impact statement is out for the Cape Wind Energy Project. If you note that back during scoping, we submitted a pretty lengthy letter to the Minerals Management Service about the energy project there, the wind generating farm, about essential fish habitat and safety, fishing safety. And I recommend that we task, or if you have no objection, I'd like Chad, who's replaced Leslie Ann, to review the DEIS and prepare comments for the council. And if there is a habitat meeting, have them run those through the habitat committee, if there's another one specifically scheduled. If not, I'd like the council to allow you to sign off on those comments about Cape Wind Energy. The deadline is March 20th for comments, so there won't be enough time for the full council to review them. If I can get direction on that. Admiral Sullivan will be joining us this afternoon at 1:30. The Coast Guard just completed the casualty investigations of the Lady Luck and the Lady of Grace, and he'll be discussing those with us this afternoon. And also at the next 3 days, the restaurant in here is going to set up a buffet for everyone. So you'll see some signs around for $11 or $12. They'll set up a buffet for lunch every day, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Paul. So back to the Cape Wind issue. You're going to have staff review the EIS, and then if there is a habitat meeting scheduled, before it's March 20th, you'll have the Habitat Committee run through it. If not, you're asking if I can sign off on comments from staff concerning that. So is there any objection or questions? John Nelson objects. John.
I certainly don't object. Let me try this one, Mr. Chairman. That happened to me last week at ASMSC. I think it's an omen, you know, wearing out the mics. I certainly don't object to that process. I'm just wondering if we can insert a an interim step if there is not a Habitat Committee meeting. Perhaps that letter could still be circulated to the committee members, and they could provide any feedback to the chair, who ultimately could give it back to you, and that way at least that it's touched base with that committee.
Yeah, that good suggestion. We'll do that. Okay. Pat Kirkle.
Thank you, and good morning. Couple of issues, items rather. The final rule to implement the standardized bycatch reporting methodology amendment published in the Federal Register this on January 28th. So the effective date for that rule will be February 27th. As requested by the VMS Enforcement Committee, a comprehensive VMS question and answer letter has been completed. The Q&As contain answers to commonly asked questions regarding the regulatory requirements, operations, troubleshooting the VMS units, and a permit holder letter announcing its availability on the homepage, which can be accessed from our website, will be mailed to all vessels that are required to have a VMS. On January 29th, we sent a permit holder letter to all multi-species limited access permit holders informing them of the two deadlines regarding submission of final sector rosters to the agency. For sectors that wish to receive allocations based on individual catch histories, the sector manager must submit a complete roster of participating vessels by March 1st. And confidentiality releases must be provided by June 1st. For sectors that are willing to receive allocations based on aggregate catch history data, which would not require confidentiality releases from the vessel owners, the sector manager must submit a complete roster of participating vessels by May 1st. In order to calculate sector allocations for fishing year 2009, vessels may not be removed from a sector roster after June 1st. We're sending up a follow-up letter to further explain the concept of sectors to the industry and to revise some of the contact information. On February 6th, we sent a letter to permit holders informing them that the 18-inch haddock minimum size that was implemented through emergency action was extended. That 18-inch minimum size will now be in place through August 11th of this year. And that's commercial haddock only. We published a proposed rule in the Federal Register on January 3rd that proposes the 2008 total allowable catches for the U.S.-Canada management area. The comment period on that closed on February 4th. The proposed U.S. Tax for cod haddock and yellowtail flounder are 667 metric tons for cod, 8,050 metric tons for haddock, and 1,950 metric tons for yellowtail. The proposed rule also recommended the delay in the FY 2008 fishing year 2008 opening of the eastern U.S.-Canada area for trawl vessels until August 1st. We're preparing the final rule for that action now. As of January 24th, 2008, all federally permitted vessels fishing in the western U.S.-Canada area are prohibited from harvesting and retaining yellowtail flounder. 100% of the total allowable catch of Georges Bank yellowtail flounder has been caught. The eastern area will remain closed through the end of the fishing year. Under the leasing program, between May 1st and February 11th, we've processed 472 leases. Of those, 448 were approved. That represents over, 543 distinct permits. The total days at sea leased, 11,526. And the average cost per day at sea leased was $488.37. I'm sure you'll be shocked to hear that we determined that the recommendations from the Mid-Atlantic and the New England Council on dogfish were not consistent with the fishery management plan. So we've continued the 4 million pound quota with the seasonal split of that quota and the trip limit for 600 of 600 pounds for 2008. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thanks, Pat. I had one question concerning the permit holder letter that was sent out with regard to sector allocation, the ground fish plan, and the dates, March 1st, May 1st, and June 1st are dates that are important for people that are hoping to be in ground fish sectors for 2009. Two questions. You stated, and the letter states, that vessels can't leave a sector after June 1st, can't get off the roster after June 1st. What happens if they do? And then I guess the question is, are there regulations that prohibit them from leaving, or they can leave, but then they jeopardize everyone else that's in the sector? Is that?
They jeopardize the sector.
Okay. So if a vessel were to leave after June 1st, then that sector may not be authorized for 2009, or there may be a delay in authorizing that sector because you'd have to recalculate the information.
That's correct.
Okay. And the second part was, you mentioned you're going to be sending a follow-up letter out to the industry. Is it going to be more clear on what's needed to be submitted on those dates, other than, I think the perception was you just have to send in a list of vessels that are going to be in the sector. Is it more than that? Is it, I've heard that there's the need to submit a contract and signatures and everything else. Is that accurate?
George, you see, I haven't seen the letter yet.
Okay, well, maybe we'll bring it up on the ground fish tomorrow.
Okay.
Questions for Pat? Dave?
Yeah, actually, I don't know if maybe it would be better to cover a lot of this underground fish, but the letter has raised a number of questions. Now, my phone is rung off the hook with people wanting questions answered that I quite frankly can't answer because we haven't answered them yet. So are we going to have a discussion underground fish of outstanding questions and sectors and answers that we can provide to people before March 1st so that they can make a logical decision about what they're supposed to do?
Yeah, I think we have to. Starting tomorrow, Wednesday, and then all day Thursday is dedicated to ground fish, and I think that letter that has been sent out and the letter that's about to be sent out need to be discussed by the council so the council understands what's going on out there from the services perspective as well.
Okay. So we're going to have a lengthy discussion then because I have, you know, a couple pages of questions here that people have called and asked me, and I don't have the answers to them. But one of the questions that's kind of overarching to all of this that I'd probably ask right now is, if somebody is enrolls in a sector and they're still in that sector after June 1st, but then we decide we can't get sectors done for 2009, where do they stand? You know, in other words, do they just have to sit out the 2009 fishing year, or is everybody going to get dumped into the days at Seapool? Or, I mean, that's probably the most overarching question that people have right now is, you know, what happens to me if I sign up for a sector and then you guys don't get them done?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure Pat wants to answer that right now, but I think that is the type of question we need to answer tomorrow and Thursday. Questions for Pat? Paul Howard.
Just to be clear, Pat, I heard there was some confusion about what does this actually mean. For those 17 sectors that we have in development with Amendment 16, these requirements of the, you know, submission requirements are for those 17 sectors. It's not for new sectors. It's for the ones that we have under development now.
That's correct.
Anyone else for Pat? Anyone in the audience? Okay, thanks, Pat. No general counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Couple of lawsuits to report on, one involving this region and another sort of having a national interest to this council. The agency was sued by the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance and Midcoast Fishermen's Association end of December. We received the lawsuits, were served with the lawsuits at the beginning of January. And Earth Justice, an environmental law firm, is representing these two fishing groups, primarily located in Maine, based on their description in the lawsuit. The plaintiffs have sued us for our decision to deny a petition by them to for rulemaking, for emergency and permanent rulemaking, to take away the exemption for midwater trawl vessels to fish in groundfish closed areas with midwater trawls. The petition basically said that the foundation for the exemption for these vessels to fish in groundfish areas is no longer valid, which is that they take little or no or insignificant amounts of groundfish in their activities, and that this justifies that this creates a significant problem for overfishing and rebuilding objectives in the groundfish plan, and therefore should these vessels should immediately be banned from groundfish closed areas. The agency denied the petition basically on grounds that there is no new sufficient or significant information presented by the petition to change the rule that it had been considered by the council over a number of years, and there was no information presented that would justify an emergency or permanent rulemaking done by the secretary. We did mention to these petitioners that they could bring this problem up to the council to see if the council wanted to address it. So the agency was sued on its denial of the petition, basically on several grounds. One is that it's a violation of the Administrative Procedure Act to have denied it based on the information presented. They also claim that denying the petition results in certain Magnuson Act violations, including failure to stop overfishing and rebuild depleted fish stocks, failure to minimize bycatch, failure to rely on best scientific information, and failure to comply with emergency rule guidelines that the agency has submitted, that agency has published over the years. So we will be defending that lawsuit in due course. The other lawsuit that's of interest is a appellate court decision in the District of Columbia that overturned a district court decision involving a groundfish amendment in the North Pacific. And this is a groundfish amendment sort of styled as a groundfish retention provision. It was designed to prevent or to minimize bycatch in the groundfish fishery up in that region. And the issue at hand was whether the agency drafted the regulations to implement this amendment. The council had submitted the amendment with an outline of what it considered to be the necessary regulations to implement the amendment, including some enforcement provisions for determining whether the groundfish retention rule was being complied with. The agency, in drafting the actual regulations, added some enforcement provisions that were not specifically described by the council. The Fishing Company of Alaska sued, claiming that these additional enforcement rules went beyond what the council had recommended. And the district court found for the agency, but the appellate court overturned the district court's ruling basically on grounds that the council had not deemed these new regulations that the agency came up with as necessary and appropriate for implementing the regulation. There's provision in the Madison Act in 303C that says that the council shall deem necessary and appropriate regulations to implement its recommended actions. And there was no formal deeming of these particular regulations by the council. The agency had actually sent the regulations back to the executive director to review and then to submit to with the amendment itself to the secretary in the formal submission process. But the court found that the executive director never formally deemed these new regulations on behalf of the council as necessary and appropriate. And so the court found that those that part of the regulations were not properly implemented. So this has raised a question throughout all the councils in the country as to whether the councils are adequately complying with this provision in 303C to deem as necessary and appropriate regulations, proposed regulations that are designed to implement the council's actions. And it's something that I think there'll be some national guidance on, but in the meantime, we're moving forward with different actions, and we have to, you know, the council has to, at least on an ad hoc basis, wrestle with whether it is fulfilling this requirement to deem proposed regulations necessary and appropriate. And, of course, in this region, the regional office does the drafting, the actual drafting of the regulations. And this is usually done after the framework action, the amendment, the FMP is submitted to the agency for review. We actually have a couple of actions that have been submitted that were in the process of drafting regulations for at least a couple that I'm aware of. One is Framework 19 in the scallop fishery, and another is Framework 5 in the monkfish fishery, in which there's probably not an actual deeming of these regs or anything that flows out of the frameworks for these actions as necessary and appropriate. And Paul's going to be, I think, putting forward a motion at some point during the council meetings, an action that would satisfy, at least on an ad hoc basis, this requirement for the council to deem regulations necessary and appropriate for your consideration. I think the national guidance is going to be that the council should look at their SOPs and review how they want to comply with this requirement in a formal, direct way. I know Alaska, the North Pacific Council, is looking at several ways to do it. One of the ways they're looking at is whether the council actually needs to look at the regulations or whether they can actually just sort of give an outline as to the types of regulations that are necessary to implement a particular amendment or action, and then deeming any regulations that directly come out of those that outline as necessary and appropriate without actually seeing the regulations themselves. And just to round out this discussion, there's another provision in the Madison Act that allows the Secretary to unilaterally promulgate regulations that are necessary to carry out the actions of the Council consistent with the Madison Act and other law. This is Section 305D of the Madison Act. We've interpreted that over the years as giving the Secretary some discretion to unilaterally add administrative and some enforcement type of regulations that the Council might not have specifically considered in order to ensure that the Council action is carried out in a manner that's consistent with the action itself as well as with the law, the Madison Act and other applicable law. And a number of our, if not most of the implementing regulations that the agency has adopted relies in part on that particular provision. That provision, we feel, is not subject to the deeming requirement because it's outside the scope of implementing the exact regulations or the measures that are included in FMP and are more within the purview of the agency to figure out in terms of its budget and manpower and other capabilities. So there is a nuance between some between the kinds of regulations that are necessary to carry out an FMP under 305D and those that are necessary and appropriate under 303C. I think that's all I want to say about that. I'm willing to answer, to the extent that I can, any questions about it. And I don't have anything else to report. I might just give an update. You know, we have a couple other pending lawsuits in which there's been no further action. One is the lawsuit challenging the permit splitting provision in Amendment 1 of Herring. brought by some herring vessel owners. That is, we're revising the administrative record for that case, and we expect some motions for summary judgment to be filed fairly soon by the plaintiffs in that lawsuit. We've also dealing with challenges to the last ground fist actions by Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and there's been no activity on that lawsuit whatsoever. So those are still pending and sort of languishing at this point in time. And that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Gene. Any questions for Gene? Dave?
Yeah, Gene, perhaps you heard recently there was a ruling about the Navy and executive orders and the fact that they violated NEPA. Does that have any practical effect on things we do in terms of, you know, basically like issuing emergency actions or anything? Are we now going to have to comply with NEPA for any kind of a special rule or anything, or is it two totally separate things?
Well, I'm not familiar with that particular issue that you talked about, but we comply with NEPA with every action that we take. Sometimes it doesn't mean that we do an, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean we do an EA or an EIS, but we have to show why any of our actions are in compliance or consistent with NEPA. So all of all of the emergency actions we take have NEPA provisions, and so I don't think it will change the way we do business and with respect to this council.
Anything else for Gene? Okay. Thanks, Gene. Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Nancy?
Thanks, John. The reason Jim Weinberg isn't here is that we're hosting the small demersal working group, which is the SAW portion of the summer flounder assessment in Woods Hole. So at this point, as far as the report is concerned, you're obviously stuck with me, and hopefully I'll be able to address any questions that come up. The first thing that we were asked to review were the GARM data methods meeting, which was recently held at the center in Woods Hole. And that was the 29th of October to the 2nd of November. And this was the first of four GARM meetings being held this fiscal year. The other three meetings, as you know, are the assessment models meeting, which is the end of this month, the biological reference points meeting, which is in the spring, late April, early May, and then the final assessment, which is scheduled for the first week of August. So obviously, as the first meeting and the data meeting, it sets the stage for all the other meetings that follow. The purpose of the meeting was to review seven types of data inputs, including landings, discards, tagging, fishery independent surveys, industry-based surveys, ecosystem aspects, and the recreational data for the groundfish assessment review meetings, which come up next. And there were a total of 34 working papers reviewed at the meeting. And the papers were peer-reviewed by independent experts. Now these experts, I think people know who they were not the CIE in this particular panel. But we've been fortunate to be able to convince Bob O'Boyle to chair all the meetings. And I think that's really important to have that kind of continuity throughout all the GAR meetings. We're going to have different people, obviously, participating in these meetings, and to have that continuity at the chair, I think, is very important. The panel... Huh? Bob O'Boyle, I think, was recently appointed to the SSC, wasn't he? Maybe not, but Bob O'Boyle is a Canadian fishery scientist who has recently retired and as a result has become a consultant. And he has a strong quantitative background in stock assessments and has a long history working with the Fisheries Service and not only the Northeast, but in the Pacific as well. And so we were very fortunate, in my view, to be able to get him to participate in this. And, of course, now that he's a consultant, he's probably busier than he ever anticipated being because he is that good. There's a summary report on the data methods meeting, which is available on our SAW-SARC website. So if you're interested in seeing the down and dirty details, you can go to our SAW-SARC website, and the report is there. But just as far as some of the decisions that were made relative to data, as far as the commercial landings are concerned, a new multi-tier trip-based allocation method has been implemented to combine mandatory dealer trip data with vessel trip reports to obtain area fished and effort associated with every dealer trip. And this is a major advance which will make better and more efficient use of the commercial database for stock assessment. As far as the discards are concerned, many topics were reviewed, such as estimation of discards, sources of bias in discard estimation, and adequacy of sampling coverage. Tagging studies, some of the topics covered included cod and yellowtail flounder stock definitions, migration patterns, as well as how to use the tagging data in stock assessments. As far as the fishery independent survey information is concerned, there was discussion about survey design and the difference between design-based and model-based estimators of survey biomass. The industry-based surveys, the reviewers read previous peer reviews of the three industry-based surveys which have occurred in the New England region, and the panel offered comments on what characteristics of an IBS were needed to use the survey data as an index of population abundance or biomass. As far as the ecosystem aspects are concerned, the panel reviewed evidence for temporal changes in life history characteristics and in the environment and made recommendations about how to treat life history changes in stock assessments. And the panel also received an update on plans for ecosystem-level analyses in the GAR. And this is integrated entirely, this being the ecosystem questions in the GARM as we proceed. As far as the recreational data are concerned, the available recreational catch data on Atlantic cod, winter flounder, and haddock were reviewed. And I think everybody understands that the primary purpose of the data meeting is to make decisions about the quality and quantity of data that are available and what are appropriate to consider and apply within the assessment as we proceed. So the next meeting, as I indicated, is the assessment models meeting, which will then craft the assessment model or models that will be applied, and these are the data, obviously, that will be applied in that process. As far as survey work is concerned, we conducted a 3-day workshop on bottom trawl technology and standardization as part of our regularly scheduled training program to enhance and maintain gear and survey standardization skills among our survey staff and vessel personnel. And the topics that were covered included all subjects and material identified by the Trawl Survey Advisory Panel and the workshop. We had a lot of people attend that. We had 42 people attend that. And the center intends to conduct similar workshops on an alternate year basis based on recommendations from the panel. And the last workshop that was conducted was approximately 2 years ago, so we're looking at an every other year schedule from now on. And the workshop represented the center's response to motions passed by both the Mid-Atlantic Council in December of 2006 and the New England Council at its February 2007 meeting. The Bigelow itself is having work done on the auto trawl system, and I think everybody's aware that we had a long list of repairs that were required for the Bigelow, which I don't think comes as any great shock to anybody. We are on schedule to get the Bigelow in the water, and we do plan on starting the spring bottom trawl survey in early March. So that is still on schedule. We're also in the process of working with the University of Delaware to obtain their vessel. It's what we call the UNOLS vessel, which is actually a National Science Foundation ship. The National Science Foundation has a fleet of vessels that we call UNOLs, and I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but that when we say UNOLs, and I think we throw that around pretty cavalierly, that's what we mean. But we are in the process of obtaining the University of Delaware UNOLs vessel, which is the RV Sharp, to conduct the scallop survey. So that's underway as well. And the last thing I wanted to mention, again, was the SARC schedule. Obviously, between the GARM, which we're heavily invested in, and the center staff are pretty much preoccupied with and will be through the summer. The other major issue that we're dealing with in the summer, obviously, is summer flounder. And that will that's the SAW portion that we'll have. This week, we may end up having a follow-up meeting as a result, and that SARC is scheduled for June. So between summer flounder and GARM, we're pretty busy. So that's what I've got.
Paul Howard.
Couple things. Nancy, Dr. O'Boyle is on our SSC, so I'm glad to hear you say such nice things about him. Second thing, I understand that the Science Center is now required to complete a NEPA document or an environmental assessment about the research surveys. And it's my understanding that federal research vessels have a categorical exclusion, that they are exempt from federal rules because the mere fact that they are research vessels and you can't comply with fishery regs or anything like that. So I'm a little bit concerned about the resources that you might need to complete this environmental assessment for the surveys and how that might impact the council. So can you give me some assurances that this is not a huge effort and won't impact our timelines?
Regardless of how it impacts us, it will not affect our timelines with any of the activities that are ongoing with the council. We're not really sure at this point what it's going to mean in terms of a labor burden for us. We were as surprised, I guess, as anybody else that we were going to have to jump through this hoop, but it clearly doesn't just affect us up here. It's obviously every region and every science center that conducts research surveys, which is everybody. So we're trying to figure out a way to do this so that it is minimally burdensome for us, and we're working with the regional office and headquarters to figure out a way to ensure that's the case and do this in a broad way so that we cover it one-shot deal, it's over and done with, and then we don't need to deal with it ever again. So I can assure you that whatever it is that we do, it will not impact any of our commitments to the council. But we're trying to figure out what it means, quite frankly, as well.
Further questions for Nancy? Jim Odlin?
Yes, a couple of meetings ago, we asked if you could provide us with the video of the new trawl in action in the flume tank, and I was wondering if what's the status of that?
I vaguely remember that. if I don't get something in writing as a follow-up, sometimes, you know, I'm off to the next item. I don't have a problem with that. That's something that we'd be happy to do. We're happy to provide any kind of information on any of the activities that we're doing with the new vessel in particular and any of the new gear that we've developed. So, if that's something that the council would like, then I am happy to do that. I'm happy to have any of our staff come and talk and give presentations on any of the new systems, the auto trawl gear, whatever. I'm happy to do that.
Yeah. John, could we make a formal request that we receive that video presentation of the new trawl and the flume tank?
Yeah, I'll put a letter together.
Thank you.
Unless there's an objection. Okay. Gene Martin, you wanted to clarify something?
I just wanted to clarify Paul's premise for his question to Nancy. Is the scientific research, you know, any activities by the center has never been exempt from NEPA. You might be thinking that scientific fishing might be exempt from Magnuson Act, which is another question because it's not subject, if it fits within the definition of a scientific research by scientific research vessel, then it's not subject to the federal statutes and regulations regarding fishing. But there's never been an exemption for any federal action from, at least federal actions that we're involved in, from NEPA.
Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to make the council aware of some of the methodology changes that Nancy pointed out that came up under the data methods meeting. And I had a few questions to follow up on that. The GARM approved a new methodology to allocate landings to stock areas. This new method results in some changes to the recent groundfish landing streams. The center and peer review conclude that these changes are not significant, but I'd like to point some of them out to the council. For Gulf of Maine cod, 1999, the new method landings are 16% lower. In 2002, the new method is 15% lower. In 2003, the new method is 10% lower. For Gulf of Maine haddock, 2001 through 2003, the new method is 17% lower. For southern New England and Massachusetts yellowtail flounder, 2000, the new method is 15% higher. In 2001, the new method is 21.5% higher. In 2003, the new method is 19% higher. It's hard to believe that changes in landings in the 10 to 20% area will not affect our understanding of stock status, in which direction, I'm not sure. But another example is that if the mortality for Gulf of Maine cod changed about the same as the landings, then we might have only needed a 25% reduction in framework 42 versus a 35% reduction. And for southern New England yellowtail flounder, our problem might be in the opposite direction. Maybe we should have done more. So I get a couple of questions here. And can you give us some examples of how the landings changed as a result of the new allocation method? And given the magnitude of the changes in landings, how is this likely to affect mortality and stock size estimates that the council was provided in the past?
You're asking me for these. I can't really address any of the specifics. I don't really know the answer to that. But what I can presume is that we have additional information which has allowed us with greater precision to allocate landings in terms of area fished. And I can only presume, not having been involved in any of the previous assessments, that we have this new multi-tier trip-based allocation method, which, like I said, results in greater precision in terms of where those landings are allocated. How those landings and changes in landings are going to affect the outcome of the assessment, I cannot address that either, because there are so many pieces that go into the assessment. For example, one thing I mentioned was ecosystem aspects. What we're seeing, for example, is that there are changes in the growth rates for some of these stocks. And it's clear that changes in growth rate are going to have impacts not only on input productivity, but output in terms of size and age. So there's a whole realm of variables that will affect the outcome. Clearly, where those landings are and changes of landings are part of that. but when they go up or down, I can't really say at this point what that means in terms of the outcome of the assessment, because there's so much that goes into it. So I wish I could give you a more concrete answer. I can certainly go back and ask my folks for some more specific examples and pick some things out, but I just can't do that right now.
Okay, I'll follow up and with some more, and perhaps we can subsequently get some answers to this as well. The GARM 3 meeting also reviewed the allocation methods, method using data through 2003. For groundfish species, most of the landings were successfully assigned to a stock area using the new allocation method. But in 2004, the electronic dealer data was adopted, and the percentage of groundfish landings that are not successfully assigned to stock by the allocation method has increased in 2004, 5, and 6. Just some examples, cod is 3.5%, it's 8.7% in 2004, 11.3% in 2005, 6.6 in 2006. There's some more examples, but I'm not going to go through them all. And the question is, has there been an observation of any difference in the performance of the new allocation method when applied to data from the new electronic dealer reporting system, such as by data that from 2004 on? And how will the center address this problem, and when is it likely that we would have a peer review of the of this?
I honestly don't know what you mean by performance. I mean, again, clearly the allocation of landings now and in the past, in terms of looking at the previous history, has improved. So as far as the performance in terms of allocation of landings, in our view, it has improved. And that obviously was reviewed by the panel as well, and they agreed that whatever that allocation is and how it's changed is the appropriate way to go. Now, I'm not sure what you're asking me above and beyond that. Again, looking at landings and changes in landings and what that means in terms of outcomes is not particularly linear. It's not a simple one-to-one relationship. So I'm not really sure, Rip, what you mean by performance.
Tom Neese. Do you want to talk to Rip, Tom? All right, why don't you get to the mic then?
Yeah, the issue is that the peer review reviewed data through 2003, and they used the new allocation method. And that allocation method is a trip-level method, and it steps through a number of different steps to allocate each trip to a particular statistical area. When they used the data through 2003, when you look at most groundfish, now, there are some criteria as it moves through the trip-based allocation system that a trip has to meet. And there are occasionally for groundfish stocks, some trips that don't meet that criteria, and they refer to that in their report as they fall out of the allocation system or they don't enter the allocation system. When they reviewed the data through 2003 for groundfish stocks, very little of the groundfish stocks falls into that category where it doesn't enter the allocation system. It's quite often for stocks like Place, it's less than 1%. For stocks that have multiple stock areas, it's, you know, a couple percent, very small amounts. But if you look at 2004, 2005, and 2006, the number of trips that don't enter the allocation system with respect to groundfish increase. And so Rip rattled off a couple of numbers, for example, for cod stocks, where it used to be a couple percent. In recent years, it's been, I think, 8 to 11% or something like that. So if you want it, you've got a choice when you do the assessment, I think. You either ignore those landings or you figure out some way to allocate those landings to a stock area outside of the allocation system. That process wasn't reviewed at the peer review in the fall because they only looked at data through 2003 and it wasn't an issue. And so Rip's question is, you know, what is the process going to be to allocate those trips, groundfish trips, that don't enter the allocation system, and when is that going to be discussed?
I can't answer that. I don't know, and I'll have to find out, and I can certainly either report back during this meeting and find out, or I'll have to follow up. Sorry.
Yeah, if possible. I mean, we are talking about groundfish Wednesday afternoon and all of Thursday, so if you do have occasion to get an answer to that, that would be great. Otherwise, probably follow up with pen and paper. Anyone else for Nancy? Dave Gaith.
Well, I don't know if it's for Nancy or Rip, but the information that Rip is quoting from, is that available somewhere for, I mean, is there a website we can go to and look at it, or is it a summary of a meeting, or, I mean, I'd like to look at the information.
Tom, isn't that the
all of the documents from all of the working papers are available on the center's webpage. And the peer review is also available on the center's webpage. They're all, I don't remember the exact link, but if you go to the page that starts the SAW documents, there's right at the top, they have the GARM stuff. And the first two working papers A1 and A2, I think A1 describes the allocation method, talks about this issue of when landings do or do not enter the allocation system. Paper A2 does a comparison with the new allocation system and the old allocation system for not quite all of the groundfish stocks, but probably most of them. I don't think they do it for things like plaice that are single stock species, for example, but they do it for yellowtail cod and haddock, and I'm pretty sure winter flounder. And so they compare the landing streams under GARM 2 and the landing streams that result from the new allocation system, and they show the differences.
Anyone else for Nancy? Paul Howard.
Just quickly, Nancy, this flume tank video, has that been reviewed by your staff, and are there findings or a summary of the review? And can this, you know, I don't think it's going to be any benefit to the council to show a video, and I know what those videos are, without any type of presentation and summary of what the council is looking at. So, is it possible for the April council meeting we can have a one-hour presentation with the video about what actually are the findings of reviewing the video operation and the flume tank?
Yeah, I mean, much of what we're talking about is purely descriptive, and that's fine. But, let me get back with my folks back in Woods Hole and let me talk with them. I don't see that there's a problem with that. We can certainly provide that. As far as the review is concerned, again, like I said, much of what this is purely descriptive, but we're happy to share it with anybody anytime.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone else in the audience? Okay, thanks, Nancy. Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council Liaison. Jimmy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you didn't have a representative down for this meeting, but I'll be glad to fill in if you like.
Please.
And if you don't mind, while you're speaking about this video, this the Troll Committee was deeply involved with observing these nets in the tank and making recommendations to the Science Center for the gear. I think what you want to try to do, it would be in your best interest to have the same video that was presented, and I believe our council got it, It's a comparison of the Albatross's 36 net and the new gear. And it would is some excellent footage of both gears in the tank. That would be helpful. But I strongly suggest that you tie it to the same meeting and the same day, if possible, that you have the NEMAP presentation. Because the NEMAP presentation is going to be 150 tows of that gear in use in the real world in a full scientific form. You know, so if you tie the two together, what you would have an opportunity to do is to view it as it's being utilized. So it might be beneficial to look at it in that realm, because the consistency that was trying to be achieved as we developed this gear is fully demonstrated in the NEMAP presentation. It's just, you know, it'd be a little clearer in people's minds, but I think the question that was raised earlier on about this was to actually look at both gears in the tank, not just the new gear. That was my interpretation, but anyway. We met in Virginia, Hampton, Virginia, on the 29th through the 31st, and it was basically a kind of a light agenda. We did have some issues to take care of. Under normal conditions, I would say that it was kind of a poor meeting because we really didn't have a lot to deal with, but I just came off of your one-day council meeting, and once again, you made us look like shining stars, so thank you for that. And let's see, what we had to do, we had to add language to a proposed rule for butterfish, which changed some of the wording for the bycatch or the incidental trip limits. Butterfish have been determined to be overfished, and because a lot of the bycatch occurs in the Lalago fishery and the directed butterfish fishery doesn't amount to much, we basically traded the poundage inserted as bycatch instead of a directed fishery, so we have trip limits, and we clarified the language on that. We had a presentation by the NEMAP, by VIMS, on the NEMAP 2007 fall cruise. That was well received. They do a good job with that, and hopefully that's scheduled for your April council meeting. And a couple of things that came up, ironically, that I think are of interest to this council. One of them came up under a new committee that we've got, which is bycatch, and it's bycatch LAPP, and the eliminator trawl, for some reason or other, got to be the hot topic of discussion at that meeting. And it was because they had copies of some of the northern publications that have provided documentation that this gear has been awarded a environmental award by the WWF, the designers of the gear. One of them is my brother, and his son is involved with it. URI is involved with it. There's a lot of interest in this gear, and the concern of the committee down there was, why is it not being forwarded to be reviewed and to be utilized in the New England area? So I was kind of surprised that it took on a life of its own down there. What they're trying to do with that committee, sir, is to make sure that research projects that generate some positive results get incorporated into management in a useful manner. And because of the eliminator situation, it just became one that they could point to and say, this is exactly what you don't want to happen. And there's got to be a way to have a mechanism once a project passes the muster of its tests and is proven to be a efficient gear or an efficient pot or whatever it might be, that there's a mechanism that it automatically becomes something that's sent forward for continued review or acceptance or whatever is necessary. So that kind of surprised me. The other one that I think was interesting was the RSA committee. They're talking about trying to utilize some of the research set-aside projects and incorporate them in the same manner that you all do with your research projects as far as incorporating the data. And there's some suggestion that they may be able to get away from the grants process or the full-blown review that we are having to go through with grants. And if, in fact, they're able to do that, it would certainly simplify through RSA proposals. Let's see. There was a presentation for protected resources. It appears that the harbor porpoise issue, there seems to be increasing takes in southern New England and the mid-Atlantic, and the harbor porpoise take reduction team had met in Philadelphia the previous month, and there was a report on that. And I'm not quite sure why, but during the discussion under protected resources, because under protected resources it came out that white marlin does not warrant listing as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act. That was, in fact, being placed there, but the determination is that it is not necessary, which comes to quite a relief for the Mid-Atlantic sport boats. That's a highly prized sport fish in that area. The other issue with the executive committee discussed the existing SOPs for the council in regard to the SSCs and did choose three new members for its SSC committee. And finally, this one I think is important. The surf clam ocean quahog fishery in the Mid-Atlantic has always been considered the prize ITQ fishery. It's what the example that should have been set for all councils around the country and all of this by some. I'm not one of the some. I think it sucks. I think it has from day one, and it's become quite apparent because one of the requirements that the service is asking for future LAPPs is the word excessive shares. And you all need to watch this one. You need to watch it close. Because initially the clam fleet, there was a lot of small operators in the clam industry when the plan started being developed. And they no longer exist. They didn't exist 5 years into the plant. But what jumps out at me more than anything was the chart that describes the allocation of the existing surf clam, the percentage of allocations. In the beginning, there was 133 active boats. Now there's less than 36. But if you look on... under the owners compromising the top 10%, I'm not going to mention the first two, but the last four is First Pioneer Farm Credit, Wachovia Bank, Wachovia Bank, and Wachovia Bank. There's the major portion of the shareholders of the surf clam quota. I don't think that was the intent when this plan was developed. And I can tell you just how that happens. It's just a matter of that becomes collateral. The allocation becomes collateral. And what happened in surf clams, and I don't think anybody will disagree, when the major players got together and a man had his allocation, if clams are worth $20 a bushel, he'd just say, $20 a bushel is what they're worth. We're only going to pay you $10. Didn't take him long to lose his finances, and the bank ends up with the quota. And guess who ends up with the quota from the bank? So there's a lot of issues associated with this. Comes up under the title of excessive shares. Just a word of warning. Be careful for something like this. This was not the intent of this from day one, and it should be something that you all need to recognize could happen to any LAPP. I think that pretty much, Mr. Chairman, covers the meeting. And again, thank you for the opportunity. And if I have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Thanks, Jim. To your comment about our last one-day meeting and then going home, and you know, anything we can do to make you look better, you know. You can use it, and we're happy to do it. To your point on the Eliminator trawl, today, I'm not sure if it's today or tomorrow, we have an agenda item on the process of how gears work their way through from peer reviewed through the RSC, so on and so forth. So you'll get an answer tomorrow. Any questions for Jim? Okay. United States Coast Guard.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to start the first part of this morning's presentation with a quick slideshow that EJ put together. It shows some of our most recent search and rescue activities. Usually our crews get a little preoccupied with maneuvering and seamanship and establishing tows and so on, but occasionally someone's able to grab a camera and take a few photos. So we'll just show a few pictures while I start my presentation. This report covers the period from November 1st to January 31st. Thankfully, there were no at-sea commercial fishing deaths to report. However, even though they didn't occur at sea, I feel the two recent cases bear mentioning. In January, a crew member from the fishing vessel Arcturus, homeported in New Bedford, Mass., fell over. The pier, while crossing from the pier onto the boats, in an attempt to rescue him, the captain also went overboard. Both men were unable to climb back onto the pier or the boats and resulted in their drowning deaths. That's being investigated by the New Bedford police. Also in January, while conducting maintenance during a winter haul, a welding contractor fell to his death into a fish hold. It's being investigated by OSHA. I mention these cases only to serve as a reminder that even inside the harbor, we operate in a dangerous workplace, which requires one to be alert at all times. There were five lives saved in November. Life rafts, immersion suits, and EPIRBs continue to be the leading equipment in saving lives. There were nine injuries reported since November, nine medevac cases. Of these medevac cases, seven were due to illness, and two were due to onboard accidents. We worked 49 SAR cases. 28 were equipment casualties, such as engines or rudders or shafts. Five were disabled due to nets in their screws. 21 other vessel casualties were reported during the period. Nine vessels were taken on water. Seven vessels were reported running aground, and there were three fires and two collisions. 15 vessels were towed in as a result of these casualties. We had 12 vessels sinking during the period. 12 vessels sunk during this last three-month period. One vessel sunk with a person on board while fishing near Blue Hill Passage in Maine. The member was rescued by another fishing vessel working in the area, and hung gear was determined to be the reason for the sinking. The remaining 11 sinkings occurred while the vessels were either at the pier or tied to their moorings. No lives were ever in jeopardy in those cases. 203 commercial fishing vessel safety examinations were conducted, and of the 203 examinations, 113 decals were issued. There were 30 EPIRB activations, none of which were actual distresses. For enforcement, the district conducted 564 domestic fisheries and marine protected species boardings with an observed compliance rate of nearly 97% and an observed safety rate of nearly 72%. 144 vessels were issued minor safety violations. The most common safety violations were expired visual distress signals, expired hydrostatic releases on survival craft, expired hydrostatic releases and expired batteries on EPIRBs, fire extinguishers not being charged, and survival suit problems when the survival suits were in such difficult condition that they were deemed to be unserviceable. 16 of the vessels had enough different safety or problems that they had their voyages terminated. 16 fisheries violations were issued, two for illegal transfer or catch at sea, one for buried lobsters, two for catch overages, one for illegal possession of marine mammal parts. Of particular interest are the two closed area violations, which involved offshore lobster vessels setting gear 3 days prior to the opening of the area to lobsters. At the time of the boarding, each vessel had nearly 1,000 traps already set within the restricted areas, again, 72 hours ahead of the opening. Both vessels were issued violations for fishing within closed areas and directed to remove all gear from the area. If you happen to catch the news this morning, there's a very noteworthy ongoing SAR case. The motor vessel Catalunya Spirit, a 930-foot LNG carrier, was disabled in a drift pretty much halfway between Chatham and Georges Bank. There is a tremendous ongoing effort, both at sea and ashore, to ensure the safety of the crew, the environment, the cargo, and the ship. A tremendous amount of help is on scene and en route. The situation, as we know it, is currently stabilized, thanks in no small part to the Boston-based tug Freedom, who has a line on the ship, has turned her stern into the wind, and is holding position while further plans are made. So hats off to the tug Freedom, who's skippered by the son of none other than our own, Dave Gaethel. Dave, our thanks and appreciation to your boy. We all hope, and we're all acting to resolve the case in a safe and expeditious manner. The case is in the Boston papers, and if I get any updates or significant changes, I'll try and pass them along. Admiral Sullivan will join us this afternoon, and he'll be giving a presentation at 1:30 on the losses last year of the Lady of Grace and the Lady Luck. And that's all I have. Are there any questions?
Any questions for the captain? Jim Odlin.
I don't have a question, just kind of a statement that one of my vessels had one of the injuries you reported on, and we had a crew member lost a finger and crushed two others. Because of the speed of the crew in the Coast Guard medevac, they flew him direct to Mass General, and the injured guy had his finger reattached. He now has full motion in that finger. It was only 2 months ago. So I thank the Coast Guard for speed and getting him to the hospital. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you. National Marine Fisheries Enforcement. Andy?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. I'm here today with Bill Semro, who's the Northeast Enforcement Division VMS manager. And as we discussed at the last meeting, Bill is going to now address VMS issues on my behalf. I've passed out a quarterly report for the last quarter. I'm not going to read through that for you. You can do that. I just wanted to point out a couple of major cases and talk to you about one unusual case. We are currently finishing up a major case involving mislabeling of seafood that was unlawfully imported from Vietnam. I think I've told you about it before. It was catfish raised in Vietnam in aquaculture, unlawfully imported into the United States through Laos in order to avoid anti-dumping tariffs. And then it was sold in the United States, including the Northeast, as grouper, sole, carp, flounder, and pike at a grossly inflated amount of money. Over 20 companies and individuals were charged with false labeling under the Lacey Act, false entry, trafficking in illegally imported material, and conspiracy. We had a trial scheduled several weeks ago for one of the 20-odd defendants who had his charges severed from the rest of the defendants. And at the last minute, on the day of jury selection, he entered a plea of guilty. The other trials are probably going to occur as one trial unless other defendants plead guilty. This was charged in the Southern District of California. We had a choice of doing it in the Northeast and Southeast or on the West Coast. The Department of Commerce wildlife folks decided that we got the best bang for the buck to do it in the Southern District of California, even though it's a Northeast case, because that's where the original importation was made. So I will keep you posted on that. As I've said before, mislabeling is a crime wave of the future. We're trying to get out ahead of it. It affects everyone in the industry domestically as well as the world market. In the last period, we only did 7 catch seizures with the Coast Guard and our agents alone. That's a little bit less than usual. However, General Counsel is catching up on their issuance of NOVAs, and about $1.5 million were assessed in the last quarter. I think I will turn it over to Bill now to discuss VMS.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, council members. I'm Bill Semro, VMS Program Manager for the Northeast out of Gloucester. I oversee the Northeast VMS team. Currently, we're monitoring 1,493 vessels broken down by VMS vendor. We're tracking 739 SkyMate, 721 boat tracks, and 33 Tron and Tron vessels. OLE recently updated the VMS software used by the industry in order to support the regulatory changes under Framework 4 to the Monkfish Plan and also Framework 1 to the Surf Clam Ocean Quahog Plan. At NIMS' direction, the Northeast VMS vendors provided software updates to their customers in mid-December. Botrax and Tron provided an over-the-air software update while SkyMate mailed a CD diskette. Vessel owners and operators should now be running the latest software versions. For SkyMate, that version is 3.924. For Botrax vessels, it's version 10. And for Tron vessels, it's version 4.0 for declarations and 3.0 for reports. The VMS software changes include the following. Under Framework 4, a new multi-species declaration. This declaration allows vessels holding both a MULTS and MUNC Day at Sea permit to declare a MULTS A-Day trip into the Northern Fishery Management Area with the option to change to a Monk A Day at Sea trip while at sea. Owners or operators desiring to take advantage of this option must declare their intent prior to sailing. They simply go to the multi-species declaration page or macro, check off the add monkfish option, then continue with their usual declarations for gear type, fishery program, and area. While at sea, the operator then has two choices. Either change to a monkfish declaration if the incidental limit is reached and retained, or change to a pure multi-species declaration if the vessels intend to leave the NFMA to fish in the southern fishery management area. Owners and operators can quickly determine if they're sailing under the multi-species with monkfish option code, as the VMS code will be NMS-MNK, a hybrid, if you will, of the Northeast multi-species and monkfish codes, NMS and MNK. Now, due to the additional declaration text associated with this change and the technical limitations of the boat track system, we had to expand the boat track's multi-species macros from the previous two to now three separate screens. So it's getting a bit more complex. And the monkfish macro is expanded from one to two screens. Despite advance notice through a fleet-wide VMS message, some of the boat track's operators have been confused by the macro numbering changes that were necessary. They got used to using a particular macro for scallop trips, multi-species trips, or what have you. The multi-species declarations are now found at macros 19, 20, and 21, monkfish macros at 23 and 24, and the declare out of fishery declaration at macro 24. I'll pass around the current VMS declaration and form screens if you all would like to take a look at them. The second software change includes three new surf clam and ocean quahog VMS declarations. These new declarations have a unique VMS code of SCO-SFC for surf clam ITQ trips and SCO-OQU for ocean quahog ITQ trips. The third declaration is for the Maine mahogany quahog trips, VMS code SCO-MMQ. This declaration obviously was added in advance of the VMS requirement for the Maine mahogany quahog fishery next January. Finally, we also added a few other changes to the software, including scallop research set-aside declarations, and we made a correction to the multi-species catch report. The catch report has two columns for the operator to fill in both catch and discards by species. The term catch confused operators who were unclear whether it meant kept and discard or just kept. We simply changed the word catch to kept for clarification. So the operator would fill in pounds kept in one column, pounds discarded in the other. Looking ahead, we're preparing another VMS software change for the Scallop Amendment 11 in the next couple of months. Moving on to a new topic, to fulfill an earlier council request for a report on missing positional data, NIMS OLE performed an analysis of VMS data for the six-month period from July to December of 2006, and you should have a copy in your read materials. The analysis and report was prepared by our headquarters in Silver Spring, and that's because that's where I receive my programming support. The report shows that NIMS received over 97% of the almost 9 million position reports expected during that six-month period. The reasons for the missed reports, and there were about 186,000, the reasons vary, as stated in the report, including power issues on the vessel, whether they're unintentional or, in some cases, intentional. Equipment issues related to antennas, connections, transceivers, and antenna blockages. Service outages, that is, outages caused by the satellite provider, such as Qualcomm for boat tracks, Orbcom for SkyMate, or Stratos for Tron, that affect all their customers at once, are typically rare. One event not documented by the report that you have is a Qualcomm outage that I documented for about an hour and a half back in July 21st of 07. So in that six-month period, Qualcomm for Botrax vessels had one brief outage of under 2 hours. Overall, I think as the report bears out, we receive a very high percentage of the expected physician reports from the fleet, and my team is able to make informed enforcement recommendations to the agents based on that data. Turning to the activity declaration program briefly, OLE policy is for vessels that misdeclare their trip to be returned inside the VMS demarcation line to redeclare. Subsequent offenders are returned to port to end their trip. It's worth mentioning that most of the miscodings that my team sees typically involve vessels that fail to declare into one of the two differential day at sea areas, the Gulf of Maine area or the Southern New England. An operator who has no intention of fishing in a differential area but needs to seek a lee within one of these areas always has the option to send the differential area layover form from their VMS unit to avoid potential enforcement action. I also want to mention that we recently changed the format of the trip notification emails, which are automatically sent to vessels when they start or end the trip. The text was reduced to save significant amounts of monthly messaging costs and hence taxpayer funds. We've received several calls related to these emails. Operators were apparently concerned that the message was somehow directing enforcement action because it was addressed from NIMS enforcement. These messages do no more than to provide the time and date of the trip start or end, the unique trip ID number, the VMS code, and there is a brief statement from NIMS enforcement that the vessel must return inside the demarcation line to redeclare only if the code received back does not match the vessel's intended activity. A few industry members have asked me why their trip emails indicated that 2 days at sea trips they took back-to-back were recorded by NIMS as a single trip. This sometimes occurs due to a feature of our monitoring system called trip stitching. Trip stitching is necessary to keep a single trip intact should a vessel clip the demarcation line during a trip or pass through the demarcation line multiple times when they're heading out to sea, such as occurs during transits through Vineyard Sound. The demarcation line goes around Nantucket Island and Martha's Vineyard there. If the vessel is inside the demarc line for less than 4 hours and the VMS code hasn't changed, the trip remains open, remains open in our system. Therefore, a quick turnaround in port between trips could result in 2 back-to-back days at sea trips being recorded as a single trip. If that should occur, one can call the VMS team. We'd be happy to review the situation and make any necessary trip adjustments so that the proper days at sea are charged. Briefly on the VMS reimbursement program, there's still plenty of money available. Eligibility requirements pertain to Framework 17, to the General Scallop Fishery Plan, Framework 42, to the Multi-Species Plan, and Framework 1, to the Surf Clam Ocean Quag Plan. The program is centrally managed out of NIMS headquarters OLE in Silver Spring, Maryland. An owner who believes he or she may be eligible for VMS reimbursement for the purchase price of their unit should call the VMS Support Center at Silver Spring. That's 888-219-9228. And finally, I just want to draw your and the industry's attention to the Northeast Region's website. There is a wealth of information about the VMS program and Northeast VMS requirements under the fishing industry homepage. Included on the VMS page are user instructions, vendor declaration forms examples, like the one I'm handing around, the power down request form, agent and VMS team contact information, and a listing and explanation of the now 268 individual VMS declaration codes. I encourage anyone with VMS questions to call my team or to email us. We can be reached through the main OLE number in Gloucester, 978-281-9213, or the individual team members. Their phone numbers are on the website. Linda Galvin, Patty Asaro, Carol Bozinski, and Jesse Leslie. Many of you have talked to them. We can also be reached through the main mail drop at nymphs.ole.ne at noaa.gov. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Andy. Questions for Bill or Andy? Dave Gaethel, then Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Bill, for the report. It's very useful. I also wanted to congratulate your staff. I think they should be nominated for sainthood for having to deal with a number of the calls they get every day from people who are concerned or worse, panicked sometimes. At least all the times I've talked to them, they've been very polite and very friendly and have really tried to work through issues surrounding the implementation of VMS. I did have a couple of questions for you because these are questions industry has raised to me. And first of all, there are a number of people who are declaring trips. In other words, they come in, they unload, and they declare another trip even though they may not leave for a week. Is that acceptable or not? They're doing it because of the issue of the cold again. I guess the boat tracks, the LED things won't light in the cold. Rather than use the call-in system, they're declaring a trip, even though they may not end up sailing because of weather for a week. Is that acceptable or not?
Well, first, Dave, thanks for those kind words about the team. You know, they take pride in answering the phone and trying to help help folks and get them an answer. One thing to remind everybody about is the alternative declaration program that the agency put into effect several months ago. And information about that program is on the website that I just mentioned, everybody, www.nero.noaa.gov. A little bit about that alternative declaration program. You declare a trip. You go out on that trip. You come back. You're getting ready for the next trip, and the next trip is identical to the previous trip. Because of issues like cold weather where you may not be able to make a declaration on your unit, you can call into the IVR system, this alternative declaration system, prior to sailing. And there's a series of prompts. There was a permit holder letter that explained this. And what you're doing is confirming the last code declared through your VMS. This is not to be confused with calling in a trip, a days at sea trip to the IVR. This is a separate part of the IVR that will report back to you the previous code that you used. And all you do is confirm that code. Now, if the code that the IVR reports back to you is different than what you expected to hear, then you have to go through your VMS unit and send the code that way. So I wanted to remind everyone that there is that alternative declaration program out there. And again, information about that is on the VMS website through the fishing industry homepage. As far as, you know, declaring several days before you sail, well, speaking for myself, I don't see a problem with that because the trip is not going to open with that code until you sail and you cross the DMARC line. So the trip is going to be tagged with the last code you declared. As long as you don't change that code, you know, in the next several days, our system should pick that code up. Now, I don't know if, you know, Pat or Andy want to address the regulatory requirement, because I think there is still something in the regs that says, for instance, for scallop trips, you have to declare, you know, at least 1 hour prior.
Okay, thank you. That's one question. I will wait if they want to respond afterwards. My other question was, and this was a hot rumor last Saturday, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I'd like to dispel it if it's not. There was a rumor that one of the vendors had been decertified and that, you know, people may have to buy a different unit. Is that true or not?
In the Northeast region, no, that's not true. We still have three approved vendors, SkyMate, Boatrax, Tron and Tron. There's a fourth vendor, Faria, out of Connecticut, that has asked for certification in the Northeast. That approval has been delayed. I'm not in a hurry to approve that unit. It looks like a very good unit. I think it's going to be a good unit. However, the delivery method for its data is email. And that's not a reliable data method. Headquarters is going to an IP protocol for that. And once we do that, then I'll go back to testing the free unit. But to answer your question, no. We still have three approved units.
Okay. That'll put a number of nervous people to sleep. My last question is, based on your report, now you've had a chance to kind of look at these outages and they've fallen into certain broad categories, has that, you know, study of that information led to any changes that the vendors may have to make, or are the vendors, you know, looking at these and trying to, you know, improve on this situation? I mean, you know, obviously some of them are unit problems, some of them are satellite problems, some of them are still unknown. But overall, from my perception, it seems that the service is getting better than it was when it started. So are changes being made as we go along here that are reducing the number of outages?
Yeah, again, keep in mind that you really got two issues here related to outages. You got the satellite providers, which occasionally do maintenance, and there may be an outage across the fleet for a very small period of time. And then you have what I think are clearly the vast majority of missed position reports, individual reports from the vessels, due to the things that I mentioned. You know, equipment problems, operating in a harsh environment, I mean, you well know as much as anybody. Right now what we do is we handle on a case-by-case basis in terms of equipment problems on the vessels. That's something my team is doing when we do our monitoring. And we also receive a daily report on vessels that are not reporting. We track them down. We pick up the phone. We call the owners. We explain what we're seeing. We work with the owner. We work with the vendor. And typically we'll open up a work order through with the vendor. This unit's not reporting. Need to look into it. You know, but we also notify the owner. Take a look at your equipment, because it may be that just a matter of it's on a mooring and, you know, the marine battery died and they just need to go out there and get the unit powered up again. So we've been handling that on a case-by-case basis. As far as the get back to the service outages with the, you know, the Orbcoms and the Qualcomms, and you see there are four or five Orbcom service outages for an hour or two in there. I do intend to go back. We got this report recently. I do intend to go back to see if we can, you know, look at ways to reduce that. I do know on the Qualcomm side for boat tracks, you know, every 6 months, you know, they do maintenance. They do a software upgrade or something where we know we're going to lose data for a very short period of time. But again, it's, you know, it's minuscule compared to the number of reports that we receive. One thing we are doing, we have been doing, not related to missed reports, latent, but with latent reports, getting reports late from the vendor. And we saw, of the three providers, we saw the worst latency from the Orbcom SkyMate vendors. And they were running about 77% of their 77% of the reports were coming in within 15 minutes from the vessel to our server, to NIFS. And the Northeast standard is 15 minutes. We want the data within 15 minutes, near real time. 77% wasn't good enough for us. We've gone back to them. We're looking at ways to improve and tighten that up. The other two vendors were in the mid-90s. They were in good shape.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank OLE for meeting with Maine Marine Patrol and technical staff to help facilitate the technical implementation of VMS access for our officers. It's a tool that Marine Patrol looks forward to regularly utilizing for a more effective and collaborative at-sea enforcement. So thanks from Patrol.
Just to follow up to that, Terry, for everyone's information, the state of Maine has been selected as a prototype for sharing VMS information across the states under the Magnuson reauthorization. Maine stepped up to the plate, always been a good partner, and was the likely choice, and we're moving forward on that. And hopefully that is going to follow to all the other JEA states around the country.
Dana Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. I might have missed it, and maybe you can help me on the case highlights and significant actions. The 44 count on the Western Sea, there, it says it is currently in settlement discussions. Has there been any progress on that, or is that the status of that case?
As of last week when I discussed it with General Counsel, that was the status.
Anyone else? Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Bill. Bill, when there's a power outage or you lose a signal, how long does it take before you contact the owner? Is it within a few hours, within a day? Or?
I guess it depends. As you know, we're not manned 24/7. So, coming in the next morning, we start monitoring the fleet, looking at the reports coming in, non-reporting reports. Somebody could have had a power outage the night before. You know, unfortunately, that was the situation with, you know, a boat like Lady Luck. If, you know, as we're doing our monitoring, if we, you know, we may see a missed report immediately. That doesn't always raise a red flag. I mean, we're looking at trends, we're looking at the length of the missed reports, things like that.
Yeah, why I asked the question is I've been doing some work on my boat. It's been tied up for over 2 months. The other day I went down and the power was out, and I didn't know for how long it was out. It was the night before, it was previous, it was working. But in the morning I got down the boat, and everything was out. I had stone cold batteries. Everything was out. I was just wondering if it just went out or was out all night.
Well, we can look back and tell you. You're probably wondering, why didn't I get a call then right away? And, you know, with 1,500 vessels, there are power issues among the fleet. And, you know, with the various requirements, and some vessels are authorized to turn their VMS units off in port, you know, under various circumstances, herring when they enter port and general category when they send the power down code, et cetera. You know, MOLTS vessels, if they hadn't declared a MOLTS day at sea during the fish year, you know, there are all these different rules. So we look at our non-reporting list, we keep all those rules in mind, and we start making our calls. So, maybe you have a message on your answering machine. I don't know.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Dave?
Yeah, just one last brief for Andy. I appreciate the information you've provided in this update, specifically who's not supposed to be on the water. It's actually very useful to us. I mean, we know who's on the water, but we don't necessarily know who's not supposed to be on the water. So I thank you.
Anything further? Thank you, gentlemen. Final report, ASMFC. I don't believe there's a rep here, but, oh, wait, there is. What's your name again? John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Happy to give my last report of ASMFC to the council. We actually met last week, February 4th through 7th in Alexandria, Virginia. 67, 70 degrees. The number of boards met, Summer Flounder, which I always am blessed to not be on. And so if somebody else wants to provide the insight of what happened at that board, which ran over as usual, I'm going to let them do that. Otherwise, we did eel, striped bass, herring, lobster, shad, river herring, as the primary ones. We also had Tatog in there. Herring, we were looking at the reviewing our spawning closure, looking at the effectiveness of laws, looking at the overall catch last year, the quotas. New Brunswick weir fishery seems to have increased its catch substantially, and that was a concern amongst a number of the board members, and to take a look at and work with the Canadians as far as seeing what could be done associated with that, or at least compensate one way or another associated with that. We are going to hold a days out meeting in March to look at how to stretch the 1A quota out as much as possible. So the industry and the states will be meeting to discuss how to do that. Much of the time was spent on the strategic plan. We are in our five-year review and redoing of our strategic plan. There was the self-evaluation review of how well are we doing. They found a number of areas that we think we're doing well, we're doing okay, and identified areas where we were not doing as well as we wanted to do, and focused on those areas to improve and make sure that we have, by the next review, strategic plan review, that those are also in a better category. We had one non-compliance issue. State of New Jersey was found out of compliance regarding Tatog. They were the review took place. As I said, they were found out of compliance, and the necessary steps to force them back to or take the steps to come in compliance with the FMP are underway. I leave it at that, Mr. Chairman, and if there is anyone who was there and that went to the summer flounder, which David might have, so that would be great if you could update him on what happened there, Dave.
Dave?
Okay. Pat was there, too, so if I miss anything important, she'll cover me. But principally, it was to review state proposals for conservation equivalency in the recreational fishery. The technical committee had recommended a performance adjustment to the allocations for each state in 2008. That was the intent of that was to help them to stay within their target quotas. On average, on the coast, the recreational fishery's been over about 6% each year in numbers of fish, and there's a lot of variability across states. Some of them have substantially greater problems staying within their quota than others. So hopefully that will help. That those measures were approved. All the states' proposals were approved. And the other item was for SCUP. We needed a 53.3% reduction in harvest in 2008. And since 97% of the harvest occurs in the area between Massachusetts and New York, and there was a little bit of an overage in 07 in, I think, New Jersey, the Mass to New York states agreed to take care of that overage effectively. I see Dr. Pierce is here now, too, so he can help me as well. at any rate, the big thing there was to try to hold together a regional approach to recreational management for SCUP in 08. And ultimately, they were able to do that. So there are coordinated management measures from Mass to New York for 2008 with SCUP.
Okay. Anything
that
else?
Concludes my report, Mr. Chairman, unless Pat has something else to add on the since she came down to specifically attend that one meeting and, you know, enjoyed herself to the utmost, I'm sure.
Terry?
Yeah, I have one more very brief update to John's thorough report. Was the of interest to this council will be an ongoing effort by the board to address the river herring bycatch issues. And we have we reviewed the public comments of a draft PID and started to craft an amendment and add to it the development of a strategy to acquire the appropriate bycatch monitoring data and identify critical habitats and threats. And the timeline for this is anticipated to be at the summer meeting.
I knew it. Dr. Pierce.
I apologize for being a little bit late. Maybe John mentioned this. If he did, well, I'll repeat it because it's a great concern to me, and it relates to sea herring. It's the catch in the New Brunswick Weir, as you mentioned, that 31,000 metric tons. Okay, so I guess we'll have to wait and see what the implications of that will be, and that's a job for the Pelagic Committee and Frank Blount, who is now chair.
Okay, that concludes our reports. We'll take a 15-minute break, and when we come back, we'll start up with scallops. We're going to review and approve a scoping document for Amendment 15. Approve a scoping document for Amendment 15. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dave Simpson, who's the chair of the scallop committee.